Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta, my amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I bring to you today the first issue of the online World Radio Magazine for February 2009. World Radio is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. CQ Communications telephone number in Hicksville, New York is area 516-681-2922. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512. Or an email address, lowercase, handyham@courage.org. Website is www.handyham.org. So again, I state that this is the very first online edition of World Radio Magazine. And with that thought in mind, I'm going to give you a welcome to World Radio Online by the publisher Dick Ross, called K2MGA. In this business of magazine publishing, an opportunity comes along once in a while to do something particularly interesting and exciting. This is one of those times. The decision by World Radio publisher Ahmed Noble, N6WR, to retire and sell the magazine gave us the opportunity to serve a new group of readers and to jump feet first into the growing field of online publishing. All of us here at CQ are pleased to present the first ever issue of World Radio Online, a 21st century manifestation of our popular old print magazine friend, World Radio. While internet publishing has been a part of amateur radio for a while, World Radio Online is truly a different type of product. What you'll see on the following pages is the same familiar World Radio magazine format, adapted to the internet, improved, and available free to anyone with an internet connection. The features that gave World Radio its special feel and most of the columns you look forward to every month will still be here. If you haven't already done so, sign up for our free email reminder service so we can let you know when each new issue is posted. And don't hesitate to let us know what you think about how we're doing so far. I say so far, because World Radio Online is a work in progress. Yes, it's a fully functional online magazine right now, but we have some really interesting ideas still in the development stage that we'll introduce as we move along. Knowing our readers as I do, and knowing hams in general, I expect that you'll let us know what you think. But please, when doing so, remember that all of this is new to us as it is to you, too. We're learning, and we're looking for constructive criticism. Plus, of course, we invite you to supplement your enjoyment of World Radio with a parallel subscription to CQ. Enjoy. And it's signed Dick Ross, K2MGA publisher of World Radio Online, CQ Amateur Radio, CQ VHF, Popular Communications. Folks, I'll go right now to the editor's log in this introductory commentary issue of World Radio Online with the editor's log by Nancy Cott. Welcome to the debut issue of World Radio Online. The name World Radio has been changed to World Radio Online to reflect our new status as a web-based e-zine. We are very excited that World Radio Online is available to a wider readership and hope you enjoy the convenience of having your favorite magazine downloadable as a .pdf file. Down the road, our plans include allowing you to search for articles of interest by using keywords and having linkable links in the text of the magazine to take you to web pages that can provide additional information. We also plan on including direct links to our advertisers' web pages. We're counting on you to visit them and say, I saw you in World Radio Online. I have talked at length with Dick Ross, the publisher of the magazines under the CQ Communications umbrella, which include CQ and World Radio Online. He assures me that they realize that WR fills a special niche in the ham magazine world and wants us to continue as we were. We've had to do some tweaking to our columns in order to not duplicate exactly what you will find in CQ, since most of the WR subscriptions have been converted to CQ subscriptions, but I'm still the editor and most of the columnists have made the transition with us, including crusty old Kurt, Les Cobb, W6TEE, RHF mobile columnist, is taking this opportunity to retire, and you will find his final column in this issue. We don't like to see Les go, but respect his decision. I hope he will write a feature article for us occasionally, when the mood strikes him. Thanks, Les, for sharing your HF Mobile insights with us for the last 10 years. Rich Fisher, KI6SN, our QRP columnist, has shifted the focus of his column a bit. He is now writing about trail-friendly radio, which is about operating your rig, mainly QRP, and portable antennas off the grid. Operating away from home isn't just for field day anymore. Many folks are discovering the fun of operating from their campsites while on vacation or small-scale de-expeditions. Knowing how to set up a portable station using alternative power sources is more relevant than ever, as hams become more concerned about operating during natural disasters and other scenarios when the power supply might be disrupted. But we still need your feature stories and articles, just like before. Our readers have always been a treasure trove of interesting stories and building projects, and we still have pages to fill. Please, send your articles to me at the address mentioned at the end of this ed log. We have moved to a new home, but our door is still open and we welcome your input. If you have suggestions on how we can make it easier for you to read World Radio Online, or how to improve or enhance your online experience, please drop me a note. You can still reach me at nancy@tir.com or through my new CQ Communications email address, my call sign, wc8c@cq-amateur-radio.com. My postal address is Nancy Kott, spelled K-O-T-T, P.O. Box 807, Hadley, Michigan, Hadley, H-A-D-L-E-Y, M-I, 48440. Please use these addresses for sending in articles and comments. Subscription questions have to go to the address on the webpage, which is http://www.cq-amateur-radio.com. Thank you for coming with us on our new online adventure. I hope you enjoy reading this issue as much as we enjoyed putting it together for you. 73-88-33. Nancy Kott, WZ8C. We'll go now to Newsfront, World Radio Online Newsfront. FCC asks hams to assist in DTV conversion. Hams across the United States are being asked by the Federal Communications Commission to assist in the upcoming conversion of all television broadcasting to digital operation, which is scheduled for February 17, 2009. According to ARRL Media and Public Relations Manager Alan Pitts, WNAGP, amateur radio clubs across the country are being asked to develop and implement plans to provide information throughout January and February about the digital television conversion in their geographic areas. The FCC is leaving it up to the clubs to decide how to do this because they believe that local groups understand the communities in ways that the FCC does not. Pitts said that in early January, the FCC would ask ARRL section managers for the names and contact information of the volunteering groups. The FCC staff will then make contact with the groups, learn their plans, and provide them with the media, brochures, and other materials that groups and clubs may need in this effort. FCC regional staff members may even visit with larger organizations to aid in the implementation of the group's plans. Pitts stressed that hams should not make house calls, sell any equipment, or do actual installations. The request is only to distribute technical information and FCC materials only. In other words, you are not to do anything other than hand out literature and answer questions. Nor can you charge anyone for your time or effort, as this is a voluntary undertaking. Interested groups should contact their ARRL section manager. More information on this request from the FCC is online on the ARRL news page at www.arrl.org. This information was filed by the American Radio Relay League. A decision on the Mills Tower case. By a vote of 5-0, the Penn Township Zoning Hearing Board in southwestern Pennsylvania voted to uphold the permit issued to W3YNI for a 53-foot tower on its property. Quoting here, "I'm very eager to continue my hobby and continue to serve the community when I'm called upon to do so," close quote, said Chuck Mills in a telephone interview with Amateur Radio Newsline immediately following the board's decision. Mills has been battling neighbor John Dukar, who simply didn't want a ham radio tower erected next to his property. Mills says he did everything the township asked him to do, including provide proper screening. But it was PRB1 and Pennsylvania's recently enacted tower law, called Act 88, which bolstered his case. While Dukar has the right to appeal, Mills says he's hoping the battle has come to an end. "I've learned to never say never, but I'm optimistic at this point that this will be the end of it," Mills said. Michael Lazaroff, K3AIR, a volunteer American Radio Relay League legal counsel, has been with Mills throughout the process. He says Pennsylvania's new ham-friendly tower law went into effect December 8, just 3 days before the board's decision was issued. Quoting, "To the best of my knowledge, this is the first case that's been considered under Act 88 of 2008, and if so, it's very good news," close quote, Lazaroff says. As for Mills' neighbor, Lazaroff says he, too, is confident the dispute has come to a legal end. "He appears to be rather upset that the zoning hearing board ruled against him," Lazaroff says. "He does have the right to file an appeal with the County Common Pleas Court. He has 30 days to do so. However, the standard of review is pretty strict. If he appeals in order to prevail, he will have to prove that the Township Zoning Hearing Board either abused their discretion or made an error of law in denying his appeal. I don't believe he can prove either point." Lazaroff says it's time to move on. "I'm hoping that this neighbor will finally realize that it's over and he needs to move on with his life and get over it," Lazaroff says. "This is an important decision, an important victory for private property rights and for PRB 1 and Act 88. We've seen in this country a very steady erosion of private property rights in the last few years, and I'm glad to see that at least in this case that erosion has come to a stop." For his part, Mills says he has been very appreciative of the backing received from hams in his area and throughout the country. "Support from the ham community was tremendous, both in terms of moral support, financial support, and just a collective thank you to all of them," Mills says. That was filed by AR Newsline. Wichita, Kansas newspaper honors Skywarn. The Wichita, Kansas Star newspaper has recognized the key role that ham radio operators play in providing an early warning of approaching severe weather. In its December 7th story titled "Skywarn, Volunteers See What Radar Can't," the paper notes that when severe weather threatens the region, dozens of volunteer amateur radio operators and weather spotters work together to provide information to the Weather Service. Writer Tim Potter calls the Skywarn hams the eyes on the ground for the National Weather Service in Wichita. For the listener, if you're interested in following that up, you can go to www.kansas.com. One more news front piece. Reno TV station honors ham radio, MCOM. Ham radio operators provided emergency communications with the theme of a 2-minute news report over NBC television affiliate KRNV in Reno, Nevada. One of those featured was Amateur Radio Newsline's Don Carlson, KQ6FM, who explained to reporter Lamour Smoloff the way in which hams helped loved ones learn about health and welfare in a disaster area. The story also featured Jack Gutz, W-A-2-F-D-K, who has been a ham since 1934, reminiscing about the old days of the hobby. This was a very positive story about ham radio. That was filed by NBC station KRNV. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm always pleased when I see an article with the Handy Hams in our publications in digest format for listeners at the Courage Handy Ham System. On page 26 of World Radio Online for February 09 is an article by Patrick Tice, WA0TDA, the director of the Courage Handy Hams. It's titled, No Antenna, No Problem. We have a very exciting project going on right now. The Handy Ham Remote Base, an HF station that can be operated via the Internet. Brad White, K6WR, contacted me about setting up a remote base and gave me the idea. Brad wrote a QSD article on remote base operation and thought that such a station might be a benefit to Handy Ham members. Why is a remote base important? For people with disabilities, both young and old, a remote base for amateur radio is often the only avenue to get on the air. If they live in an environment such as an apartment, a retirement or assisted living facility, or condominium, it is a safe bet they cannot direct the tower, and they may not even have room for radio equipment. However, most people have access to a computer, the key to a remote base. Here is how it works. They connect via the Internet to the remote and control the remote base console just as if they were sitting in front of it to transmit and receive. They are on the air. The advances in medical technology will have even a greater effect on the need for more remote bases as the baby boomer generation ages. As people survive accidents and medical conditions that only 10 years ago were fatal, the number of people with disabilities is increasing and will continue to do so among all demographics. A certain percentage of these survivors will be amateur radio operators who are no longer in a position to get on the air in a traditional manner as they once did. Instead, they will by necessity rely on remote bases. Thanks to a gift from Kerry Ingredients and Flavors, we are able to provide this additional resource for Handy Ham members who would not otherwise be able to get on the HF bands because of antenna restrictions. The installation went even better than expected with Handy Ham volunteer Lyle Kohler, K0LR, doing the engineering work to set up a Lenovo computer with the Kenwood software necessary to host the remote base and to connect and set up the Kenwood TS-480 radio and all associated pieces of equipment. We even managed to do a dry run of the system in our extra class seminar at Handy Ham Radio Camp, where campers were able to check it out and test the accessibility features of both the Kenwood radio and the software. I do have to say that we are thrilled with Kenwood's attention to accessibility features for operators who are blind. Likewise, the control software that users will run on home computers to access the remote base is very accessible with blind computer screen reading programs like JAWS. Once the campers had a chance to do some hands-on with the station, Lyle and I transferred it to its permanent location in an attic room above Courage North's dining hall. The reason for this location is that it puts the radio in close proximity with the necessary computer networking equipment and allows us to keep the antenna a bit further away from other antennas installed at Courage North. Bill, called N0CIC, helped Lyle and I get the antenna into the air in flat-top configuration. Bill is truly an expert with a wrist rocket slingshot that he has modified for wire antenna installations. The antenna is a G5RV that will tune 80 through 10 meters. As with other G5RV installations, we found that we had to add additional coaxial cable to make the antenna tune in the phone band on 75. We decided not to use the internal tuner on the Kenwood radio. Instead, we have installed an LDG auto tuner designed to tune instantly as soon as it senses RF. This removes one complication for users. We won't have to bother tuning an antenna. Our remote-based project continues to work well. We are learning as we go and are making refinements. We are that much closer to bringing the system online as a member service. The latest is that members logging in on the members-only website will find Remote Base in the menu links. By clicking on this link, users can learn how to install and set up the software, who will be considered for user status, and so on. User status will be initially restricted to a small group of beta testers. We need to do this to work out the bugs in the system and to give us time to make the system as user-friendly as possible. This handy ham radio club station will then enter a beta 2 testing phase, during which I will need several handy ham members with excellent computer skills and plenty of operating experience to join the testing group. Once we complete the beta phase, we will then add qualified users. We are looking forward to a great new member resource that can open up the world of shortwave amateur radio operation to people who cannot have large antennas. Let us know what you think about how we are getting started, and please make suggestions as to how we can train our newer hams to use this technology responsibly. And the article is signed, Patrick Tice, WA0TDA, Carriage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, MN, 55422. There is a toll-free membership line at 1-866-426-3442. And you can check us out on the web at http://www.handyham.org. We have a nice article here. It's rather lengthy, so I'll try to get the most out of it for our listening public as possible. SS American Victory still sails the high seas. The author here is Barbara Ritter, R-I-T-T-E-R. The subtitle, Victory Ships 101. The SS American Victory, hull number 792, was delivered to the U.S. War Shipping Administration, WSA, in Los Angeles, California, in June 1945. She was named after American University in Washington, D.C., to honor the school's contributions to war training and weapons research during both World War I and World War II. Folks, I'm going to stop the article right here at the moment and surprise myself by saying, you know, that's where I went to college. I graduated from American U in Washington, D.C. way back, I think it was 1954. Wow. What a surprise to read that. So it only proves to you that I don't pre-read this stuff I put on here for you. I just hope you enjoy that comment a little bit. So let's continue with Barbara Ritter's thoughts. The SS part of her name designates steamship. The SS American Victory was one of 534 Victory ships built between mid-1944 and mid-1946 to replace the respected Liberty class of merchant vessel. The maximum speed of the Liberty ships was 11 knots, making them easy prey for enemy submarines. So early in 1942, the U.S. War Shipping Administration commissioned a design resulting in a faster, sleeker Victory-class ship with enhanced safety features. Regardless of their differences, both Liberty and Victory-class ships were vitally important to America's war efforts during World War II. The U.S. merchant fleet played a major role in winning the war, transporting an estimated 85% of the troops, ammunition, and supplies used to support Allied war efforts in both the European and Pacific theaters. Following the war, the SS American Victory served as a seagoing goodwill ambassador for the United States, supplying foodstuffs, vehicles, manufacturing machinery to the war-torn countries of Europe and the Near East under the auspices of the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. After the war, Victory ships were at the forefront of the resurgence of the United States as a world economic power and became the workhorse of American waterborne commerce after World War II. Victory and Liberty ships were crewed by members of the U.S. Merchant Marine and defended by an all-volunteer group of the U.S. Navy sailors called the Navy Armed Guard. The Merchant Marines who sailed these ships were civilians. These volunteers were from diverse backgrounds united by a willingness to serve their country in the most dangerous of services. The Armed Guard motto was, "We deliver." Now, it can be imagined the operation of these ships during World War II came with a high human price tag. The merchant marines suffered more loss of life by percentage of their ranks than any other branch of service. Additionally, the armed guard lost thousands. Now, regarding the SS American Victory, the history of the SS American Victory is a long and varied one. Incredibly, this 14,000-ton water displacement, 455-foot long steel structure, was built in 45 days. She has sailed the seven seas and was involved in World War II as well as the Korean and Vietnam Wars. SS America Victory was deactivated for the last time in late 1969 and placed in the James River Reserve Fleet, where she remained until being acquired by the Victory Ship Incorporated in April 1999. She was towed to her present home in Tampa, Florida in September 1999, where volunteers have painstakingly restored her to operating condition. The SS American Victory opened as a museum in 2001, and after over 70,000 hours of volunteer labor, she sailed again under her own power, 6,000 horsepower steam turbine engines, on March 6, 2003. Today, she goes by the name of the American Victory Mariners Memorial and Museum Ship, and is a working maritime museum located on the waterfront in the heart of the Channelside Entertainment District of Tampa. She is the only vessel of her class to be open to the public on the eastern seaboard of the United States. Today, the SS American Victory is an operational seagoing memorial dedicated to the memory of the members of the Merchant Marine and the Naval Armed Guard who lost their lives serving their country. For more details about the ship, you can go to www.americanvictory.org. But let's talk now about the radio communications aspect of this beautiful vessel. When the ship was built, the radio room had a Radio Marine Corps 4U type council. This unit had several upgrades during the time it was on board to meet FCC requirements. Some of the upgrades include a new auto alarm and a modified high-frequency transmitter was installed sometime during the late 1950s or early 1960s. During the 60s, a new complete station was installed to meet FCC standards. It was a McKay MRU 2930 unit, which was state-of-the-art at that time. Receivers and an auto alarm, etc., were all transistorized in place of the old tube units in the 4U console. The American Victory is also proud to have an amateur radio operation on board. Amateur call W4AVM, Whiskey 4 Alpha Victory Mike. The ham shack is located in the cabin deck next to the main ship station in the space that originally was for the Navy officer in charge of the Navy Armed Guard. Later on, a motor generator used to supply AC power for appliances was housed in this cabin since the ship only produced DC electricity. The amateur radio equipment included an ICOM 761 HF transceiver, ICOM 271 alt-mode 2-meter transceiver, as well as Marine VHF. Station antennas included a dipole and a vertical, operational at 10 through 40 meters, positioned about 100 feet above the water. If needed, we are also able to tap into the main ship antenna, which is approximately 250 feet in length. W4AVM is often on the air, so listen up for us, especially on the weekends. Radio Room volunteers delight in the opportunity to share with visitors about radio communication and sharing what it was like to live and work aboard a ship in the days gone by when our beloved cargo carrier ship might have been in heavy seas drawing enemy fire. Many of our volunteers can relate these stories from personal experiences, having themselves served as a merchant marine. And perhaps most importantly, the operators make contacts, lots of contacts. During a recent one-day cruise, W4AVM worked about 350 stations throughout the United States and the world. Fortunately, we have dedicated radio operators on shore willing to handle this traffic, making all of this possible. All operators are welcome to participate in these one-day cruises, and even XYLs work these events, educating the passengers, improving and cataloging the radiograms. Since records started being kept in 2006, the QSL manager reports that over 3,500 contacts have been made. Each contact gets literature about the ship, so this serves as additional value PR for the ship. We hope that you have enjoyed this abbreviated tour of the SS America Victory and the information about the radio rooms. It is our hope that when you visit Florida that you make the SS America Victory one of your ports of call. For more information about the radio club, the radio operators, or the ship in general, contact American Victory Amateur Radio Club, 3016 Cordelia Street, 3016 Cordelia Street, Tampa, Florida, 33607, USA. This very nice piece was signed 7-3 from the radio operators volunteering aboard the SS American Victory. Let's take a peek at rules and regulations. The rules say, the author here is John B. Johnston, called W3BE. John has been a faithful supplier for rules and regulations to the World Radio Magazine community, so it's good to see that he's going to continue to do so as long as possible, it would seem. Most of his stuff is in the form of technical answers, or at least clarifications of the Section 97 in the FCC codifications for amateur radio. They're in forms of questions and then answers by Mr. Johnston. For instance, here's a question. But first, a statement. Let's hope that ham radio is never delicensed. That would be the kiss of death. It would mean we aren't worth bothering with by the government. And W3BE O'Graham, answer is precisely. While an untarnished record of strict compliance with the rules might not necessarily guarantee the future of our amateur service, it sure can't hurt. Just a perception that our amateur service is unregulatable might be all that is needed to do it in. Question. How can I help? W3BE O'Graham. Read the rules and heed the rules. Is there an echo in here? Suggest some pertinent questions to your coordinating volunteer examiner committee for possible inclusion in the question pools. Draft each of your questions so that it will allow the administrating VEs to determine if the examinee knows enough about some basic aspects of the rules in order to operate an amateur station properly with the privileges granted by the class of operator license sought. After administrating each written examination, carefully review the completed answer sheet with the examinee and, for every incorrect answer, explain the reasoning behind the correct answer. This is a great opportunity to impart some positive feedback for clearing up those misunderstandings. Another question. I was saddened to read about the shutting down of our amateur radio station NN3SI at the Smithsonian Institution, as much as I was when the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia did the same thing. It is discouraging to see what is becoming a slow demise of amateur radio. What is happening to the qualified amateur radio operators? Mr. Johnson's answer in the W3BE O'Graham. They're still around, although somewhat dismayed now that the high esteem they once knew is flying out those drive-through exam windows. That BLP back-of-the-hand slap from the FCC should have been our wake-up call. Sometimes our amateur service committee can be its own worst enemy when it comes right down to perpetuating the justification for Spectrum to provide a radio telecommunications service for the purpose of self-training, intercommunication, and technical investigations carried out by amateurs, that is, duly authorized persons, interested in radio technique solely with a personal aim and without pecuniary interests. There are, however, optimistic signs. The pressure for our VHF band should slack off, at least for the time being, with the reallocation of the former VHF television broadcast bands. Good riddance of that abominable TVI menace. Those overdue sunspots are something to which we can look forward for better high-frequency propagation. The apparatus available to us from manufacturers exceed anything we could have even dreamed of only a few years ago. We must figure out, however, how to better mainstream that digital technology without our spectrum being exploited by those with other objectives, possibly sinister, in mind. And at the end of the article, folks, John wishes all of you happy Valentine's Day. I think it's time to go to Mars. Mars? Yes, Mars. The military affiliate radio system. Title here, Are We Ready? Contributing author is Bill Sexton, call N1IN. Slant is amateur call AAA9PC. It's a mighty far reach, but there is a message for America's hams in the December attack on Mumbai and the ongoing piracy near Somalia just across the Indian Ocean. Not to mention the Nazi saboteurs who landed on Long Island, New York, and near Jacksonville, Florida in 1942, or the 342 known explosive-laden balloons launched by Japan against the western United States in 1944. The four events may be far, far away in terms of distance or time, but they do speak to people involved in American homeland security, including amateur radio operators. Consider, point, in all four, the sea was an essential co-conspirator. The United States has 6,053 miles of predominantly undefended coastline to worry about. Point, neither the size of the attacking force nor the power of its weaponry was significant, quite the opposite. However, not one of these mini invasions was stopped at or over the beach. Point. The world's second largest army and fifth largest navy had no immediate response ready for the 10 terrorists who attacked Mumbai. The Western naval forces clustered in the Persian Gulf had not given serious thought to the vulnerability of vital shipping just outside, terrorized by cutthroats and small craft. The problem was mindset, and it's still around, sometimes characterized as fighting the last war. For amateur radio's approach to disaster readiness, there may be an additional challenge, the tendency of the authorities to concentrate on organizational responses to the exclusion of the individual's role. Of course, that's an oversimplification. Organizations like Mars and Ares, RACES and Saturn, and Southern Baptist Disaster Relief are essential, and the more training and drills, the better. The difficulty with training and drills is that they are patterned on the realities we already know. For example, any organization I belong to, Army Mars, everything that Katrina could teach us has been thoroughly digested and put to splendid use during the last hurricane season. But would we have a response ready for an incident totally unprecedented, unthinkable, and unpredictable, like, say, Mumbai? In this Indian city, what television showed over 2 days and longer was a breakdown of organized everything, all shattered by fear and panic. Who had bet on the initial public and governmental reaction being much different if a 100-year earthquake leveled Memphis and St. Louis and all between and kept the lower Mississippi Valley trembling for almost 2 full months? That approximates the impact of New Madrid's seismic zone activity between December 16, 1811 and February 7, 1812. The really big one hit on the latter date, except that cities weren't around then. No skyscrapers to tumble, bridges to collapse, or interstates to crumble, and that's only one scenario we ponder. We now have it on the authority of the Commission on the Preservation of WND Proliferation and Terrorism that we should expect an attack against the United States using nuclear or biological weapons before 2013. That's barely 5 years away. Who's ready for it? Quoting here, "Our margin of safety is shrinking, not growing," said the book-length report from the congressionally mandated bipartisan commission. The ham's most basic preparation for calamity on such a scale might be simply to imagine surviving one of them. That's right. Imagine climbing out of the rubble, finding some radio gear and a generator, operatable, and getting on the air in search of another live signal. Is there anybody there? Maybe not, for hours or days. There may be no one there. Imagining that last scenario is the most important part of this training session. Imagine. It's more a task for movie script writers than emergency managers. The National Incident Management System, with its meticulous blueprints for escalating response, is tailor-made for a relatively orderly wildfire or hurricane, perhaps even a slowly advancing pandemic. It won't have quite as much utility in the absence of surviving resources. Can amateur radio mobilize a countrywide cadre of hams, each prepared in attitude as well as equipment to operate, if it comes to that, all by themselves, without the support of backup or chain of command? No EOC, no EMA, no Red Cross for hours and days? Quoting again, even with all the smarts in the world, no one can dependably foresee the full dimension of future disasters, whether natural or the result of hostile action, close quote. Army Marsh Chief Stu Carter said in a broadcast to members some time ago. Continuing the quotation, though we may prepare for every eventuality, the full scope and impact of some events are beyond realistic human expectation, close quote. Sure, we can try, he said, but it takes thinking outside the box, and, if I may, a lot of imagination, too. Bill Sexton can be reached by snail mail, that's U.S. Postal Service, at P.O. Box 428, Richmond, not Virginia, Massachusetts, Richmond, Massachusetts, M.A., 01254. Or you can email him at his call, n1in@arrl.net. Folks, I earlier talked about Les Cobb, called WCTEE. Les has been writing HF Mobile for World Radio for quite a few years now, and he's decided to retire. A comment here. After 10 years, the equivalent of 64 bi-monthly columns, this column will be my last. It was my decision, made now solely because of the timing. This column has not been a hard task because I am interested in the subject. I want to make it clear that retiring is not due to the changes in world radio. It is just a window of opportunity for me. I hope to contact everyone mobile when the sunspots let our signals cross again, soon. No more columns, but send email to w6tee@qsl.net, or you can write to Les Cobb, C-O-B-B, 4114, Horgan Way, that's H-O-R-G-A-N, Way, W-A-Y, two words, Sacramento, California, 95821. 73, Les. You know, as I think about it, folks, I also mentioned trail-friendly radio. You might say, what was that? Well, it's going to be the new article by Richard Fisher called KI6SN. I'll give you very briefly what this is going to be about. It's on page 24 of World Radio Online for February 2009. As we settle into our new digital home on the web, we are excited to report World Radio's QRP column is heading outdoors. Welcome to the inaugural Trail-Friendly Radio, where we will be reporting on the growing number of amateurs who like to throw their radio gear into the backpack and operate in a field. It is a completely new theme and, in a matter of speaking, the greening of our coverage. Thanks to tremendously supportive editors at WR and CQ Communications Incorporated, Trail-Friendly Radio will be touching a wide range of topics, from the latest developments in lightweight radios and trail-friendly antennas to the many accessories that make the marriage of amateur radio and the outdoors such a happy one. There are many human interest stories to tell as well. We will be keeping in touch with such organizations as HFPAC, the High Frequency Portable Group, the International Summits on the Air, that's SOTA, S-O-T-A, the North American-based Adventure Radio Society, and more, and relaying news of their activities to you. You'll also find bonus coverage monthly on the Trail-Friendly Radio Extra blog, Now, you have to have a computer for this one, but blogs are really hot stuff on the Internet, folks. And if you're getting one or you're hoping for one from a grandchild that you took good care of many years ago, listen up. http://www.trailfriendlyradio.com www.trailfriendlyradio, one long word, .blogspot.com. Again, trailfriendlyradio.blogspot.com. Of course, the success of any column depends largely on the ideas and feedback it gets from readers. This column is no exception. Please let me know what you would like to see in this column. Share your stories of challenge and success in the field, and, of course, your questions and suggestions are always welcome. Now, this is your reader, Bob, folks. He's asking you to write to his call sign, ki6sn@aol.com. Unfortunately, Rich is not giving us a mailing address, and many of you do not have Internet capabilities or even a computer, for that matter. So if you're interested in finding out more about this and are listening to these provided recordings from the Courage Handyman system on a monthly basis, I would suggest that you contact CQ Communications Incorporated at 25 New Bridge, one word, NEWBRIDGE Road, Hicksville, HICKSVILLE, New York, NY, 11801, and comment to the fact that you'd like to be interested in more things from Richard Fisher on Trail Friendly Radio, and I'm sure they would get it to him. You know, as I had said earlier at the very beginning of the broadcast here, this is the very first World Radio Online version. And as the authors and the commentators are all saying, I say as well, it's a new experience even for me because I am reading out of printdowns from my printer from the Internet site, and I'm shuffling papers here trying to get a better rhythm. You see, some of my rhythm was a little choppy, too, and I apologize for that. We're all working on this. Work in progress. Let's move on with traffic. Regarding public relations, the author Jim Wades, W-A-D-E-S, Jim's call is W-B-8-S-I-W. As an avid hunter and angler, a recent public service announcement broadcast on the radio caught my attention. Morgan Freeman, a well-known actor, was promoting the conservation efforts of Ducks Unlimited. D-U, as it's called by its supporters, is one of the nation's best-managed conservation organizations. 87 cents of every dollar earned by DU goes directly to the habitat restoration and educational efforts. It is truly an excellent example of non-profit management. Ask the average American what Ducks Unlimited represents, and one stands a good chance of obtaining a coherent answer from hunters and non-hunters alike. Ask the average American what amateur radio or the ARRL represents, and the odds of obtaining an answer are virtually nil. More often than not, a blank stare results, or perhaps worse yet, the individual reveals an archaic conception of the amateur radio service. In an era in which the average American views the world almost entirely through the distorted prism of electronic media and popular culture, it is this lack of visibility that runs the greatest risk of condemning amateur radio to irrelevance. It is not particularly realistic to expect that a significant percentage of the population will have an interest in amateur radio any more than it is realistic to expect that a significant majority of Americans will take up duck hunting. However, it is very important that the majority of Americans have a positive conception of such activities. By using the hunting analogy as a guide, one can illuminate the issue of public perception. Despite a vocal, Hollywood-driven anti-hunting element, most reasonable individuals, whether or not they hunt, see a role for the sport. They intuitively understand the role of hunting as a necessary component in the approach to maintaining biodiversity. They recognize the valuable historic role hunting and fishing have played in the creation of our system of national parks, state forests, and protection of surface water quality, and the like. The names of the pioneers of conservation, such as Grinnell, Audubon, and Roosevelt, are familiar to many. Americans likewise note that ultimately hunters and anglers pay the bill that supports a wide range of other outdoor activities. It is for these reasons that hunting is generally supported throughout North America, even by some who may find the idea of hunting and fishing themselves a bit distasteful. Certainly, amateur radio is not as central to the human condition as issues of biodiversity and natural resources. However, it is also true that amateur radio is far less controversial than hunting, and there is little doubt that amateur radio is a beneficial activity. The value of the volunteer time and emergency communications resources provided to the public is significant. The problem is that few people know about this. While a wide range of nonprofit and advocacy groups understand the value of public perception and take concrete steps to promote public visibility, far too many radio amateurs hide in the basement. The result is an invisible hobby shrouded in mystery and viewed through a distorted lens. Far too often, radio amateurs rely on the belief that our public service mission will garner sufficient news coverage to keep the amateur radio service visible. Modern public relations professionals recognize the shortcomings of the MTV news generation. They understand that they must take control of the public relations process in order to preserve their mission by garnering positive public support. The time has come for radio amateurs to do the same. Take a lesson from Ducks Unlimited. Work with your section officials, your community, and your national associations to take control of public relations. Here are some simple tips an amateur radio group can use to increase visibility. Now, for the listener, I'll condense these. You'll forgive me, please. Issue press releases for everything. Use the Internet. It's not a mass media, but there are lots of people, millions in fact, all over the country and the world, who scan the Internet or surf the net. Don't overlook low-cost alternatives, such as neat, well-organized demonstrations at public events, such as community festivals, county fairs, and the like. Partnerships with schools, scouting organizations, church organizations, senior centers, and so forth. And that's right. Don't just concentrate on the youth. Many older people and retirees are looking for something to do and may have prior exposure to radio communications through the military or their careers or other endeavors. How about direct mailing and distribution? Is your club holding a licensing class? Start not with training, but with a one-evening high-quality presentation on ham radio. How about cable television and local newspapers? Many cable TV networks and local newspapers offer a community bulletin board feature, which can be used to list the upcoming dates and times of classes and introductory presentations. Local radio and television. If you can find a locally owned radio station, you will find that many will offer a broadcast occasional public service announcement for worthy community organizations. In some cases, a state broadcasters association will work with a nonprofit or similar groups to produce and distribute PSAs, public service announcements, promoting activities. These can fit well with the public service mission of amateur radio. Hey, how about supermarkets? Do you ever walk into the supermarket and notice the bulletins offering everything from used cars for sale to horseback riding lessons? They work. Everyone eats, and over half the population in a neighborhood will walk into a grocery store at least a couple of times per month. This can be a great place to post an announcement about an upcoming ham radio class. And, of course, there's a wide variety of volunteer groups. Volunteer fire departments, police reserves, search and rescue, and other services may have already been exposed to ham radio. However, in many cases, ham radio has not been marketed to them. Consider making a presentation to such groups on why one might want to be a ham radio operator. And you could write an article. Specialty magazines and newsletters published at the local and state level abound. Write an article telling sportsmen, snowmobile enthusiasts, cross-country skiers, and others why they might want to get a ham license for personal communications. Develop your own ideas. Ultimately, the best method for promoting any hobby is one-on-one contact with others. A QRP radio set up in a park, followed up by a conversation with a stranger, may lead a new person into the hobby. Demonstrating the high-frequency mobile radio in your car to a coworker may spark an interest. Make your hobby visible. Finally, regardless of the method used for public media relations, be sure to do so professionally. Dress well, shave, present clean, professional-appearing equipment, use good AV facilities, and so forth. It's that first impression that often makes the difference. 73, Jim Wades, WB8SIW. Jim can be reached at email jamesWades@gmail.com. And the first part is James Wades in lowercase at gmail.com. Folks, I'm not only running out of voice, but I'm also running out of this 60-minute frame that I generally use for digest reporting of the different magazines for the Courage Handyham system and those willing to listen. I will give you some hamfests in February. Just so when you're traveling around, if you're able to travel around, the middle of the winter might be a great thing to pick up. In Georgia, the first and best hamfest in Georgia, Saturday, February 28th. See, I've given you over a whole month of notice, too. Sponsored by the Dalton Amateur Radio Club. It's at the North Georgia Fairgrounds in Dalton, Georgia. The great state of Minnesota. Well, that's interesting. I'm glad I noted it because that's the St. Cloud Amateur Radio Club Cabin Fever Reliever Hamfest on February 14th. I think that's St. Patty's Day. No. It's St. Valentine's Day. St. Cloud ARC Cabin Fever Reliever Hamfest. It's at the National Guard Armory, St. Cloud, Minnesota on February 14, 2009. 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. There's VE testing at 10 a.m. You can be tucked in on 147.015, 2 meters, and so forth. More information can be seen at www.w0sb.org. Now in March, we're giving you plenty of notice here. Massachusetts to Framingham Amateur Radio Association Spring Flea Market. They're getting very, very positive here, aren't they, for better weather. The Framingham Massachusetts Amateur Radio Association Spring Flea Market will take place on March 29th at the Keith Technical School in Framingham, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Michigan. 49th Annual Michigan Crossroads Hamfest and Radio Swap is March 14th at the Marshall High School, 701 North Marshall Ave, Marshall, Michigan. And back to the great state of New Hampshire, where there's plenty of snow if you want to hurry up and take it in, ladies and gentlemen. The Contuckook Valley Radio Club Hamfest. I have to sneak up on Contuckook. Lots of Indians up in this part of the world, folks. The Contuckook Amateur Radio Club. Well, it's actually called the Contuckook Valley Radio Club. Hamfest will hold its annual Hamfest at the Henniker Community School on March 29th, 2009. The school is located on Western Avenue west of the Blinking Light on Route 114 in the center of Henniker. And lest I forget one last thing. The Aerials column by Kurt N. Zerba. It was mentioned earlier, too. This one is titled Tuned Antennas. It appears on page 38. But unfortunately, I don't have much time left, so I can't read it to you. Hi. I apologize to Kurt. Next time, Kurt, I'll be sure to put you in near the beginning. Thank you very much for your understanding. Folks, that brings me up to time for this month's reading of World Radio Online, the first online edition of this fine magazine. World Radio is now published online by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. Another reason why I was glad to get St. Cloud's Club's Hamfest into it. Hi. This recording is for the members of the Courage Handyham System, and any other use might violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. We have a fine website that's maintained all the time by really smart people, and they are really good at it, I got to tell you. The website is www.handyham.org. Your reader, my name is Bob Zeida. I spell that Z-E-I-D-A. My QTH geographic location is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, right near good old Cape Cod. 73s, and thanks a lot for listening to me get used to reading World Radio Online for February 2009.